Good evening, everybody, and thank you for coming on this, as they say in the local stations, evening of inclement weather. It's never very pleasant to be out in these circumstances. I'm delighted to see you all for this interesting session with the title that I'm sure you can see on the screen there, Managing Heterogeneity in Europe, Does One Size Fits All? Well, the answer is simple, no.
So let's go and have a beer.
Good idea, Thomas. I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of both the Institute for Global Affairs and the European Institute as the co-sponsors of this. They have managed to change the name of Erik Bergloff, who was supposed to be chairing this. And I'm delighted to step in to chair this because Thomas is an old friend. We've had many interactions over the years in his various capacities. In particular, he chaired the Economic and Financial Committee. Like, you're wondering, what is the Economic and Financial Committee? It's the shadowy committee that really runs Europe. The European Commission might think it does it, but Thomas and his friends on the EFC, they're the ones that really did it. And he's also been the chair of the Eurogroup Working Group. The politicians of the Eurogroup, the working group is the people who do the work. And to give you a description of what it does, which I've taken from their website, the Eurogroup Working Group is a preparatory body composed of representatives of the Euro area member states of the Economic and Financial Committee, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank. In other words, the power behind the throne. Now, Thomas is, in fact, in the very unlikely position of having something in common with Boris Johnson. He was born in the United States. I think that the fact that you've given up your citizenship means you can no longer be president, but it's just possible that you could succeed Trump.
No, I think the Constitution says you have to be born there.
That's enough, is it?
That's enough, yeah.
So,
but I have to reacquire it, I think.
Maybe we should start a visa for president campaign to enable you to replace Trump. Maybe?
A salary, you know.
Apart from his European functions, Thomas has been a Director General in the Austrian Ministry of Finance. And I would say that having known him for several years, he is the person who made the euro area function in its more dark and difficult days. And if there are any Greeks in the room, oh, Nico's here, the Greeks really owe Thomas a great debt for having secured Greece's future inside the eurozone. So without further ado, I would like you to put your hands together to welcome Thomas and I'll hand over to you. Thank you. And I ask you to tell us about heterogeneity in Europe.
Thanks very much. As a chair, you will tell me either to sit or to stand.
As you feel most comfortable.
Maybe I'll stand. Watch the watch.
So, thanks very much, Ian. My understanding is that I should talk for about 30, 40 minutes, and then we will have vigorous discussion and then go for a beer. I think Yanis Varoufakis would probably not agree with what you said about Greece, but it would be done. I find it very easy to disagree with him. So today I was asked to talk about managing heterogeneity, and this is something which has, as an Austrian, I was only born in the U.S. I never was an American. It was just spurious citizenship, which as an Austrian has interested me and exercised me for decades, because Austria, unlike the United Kingdom, was outside the European Union for many, many years up until 1995. And it was therefore regarded by many as being excluded from the internal market, excluded from this, that, and the other. And the small neutral countries were grouped in an organization called EFTA, which the UK actually was part of until 1973. And I started writing a paper about 3 years ago on how to deal with the increasing heterogeneity in Europe. And on the day of this stupid referendum in the UK, I stopped further writing it because of a fit of depression induced by the result of the referendum. When I'd recuperated, we started writing with a couple of colleagues and published a paper on this issue at Brügge. And why did I start writing it? Because I was sitting in Brussels at the time, we were witnessing the huge changes in Europe and the huge changes globally and how they were impacting on Europe. And this is something that you know extremely well, but to just deliver a few keywords, how we were moving towards multipolarity globally, about the breakdown of the consensus on multilateral institutions and how they could or should manage globalization. And especially what we've been witnessing over the last 2 years makes one ask, will this new world, the old one will not come back, will this new world be a world with one set of rules like we had at the WTO and other organizations? Or potentially will it have multiple sets of rules, one kind of rules that are agreeable to, let's say, the Northern Atlantic community, and another set of rules that are agreeable to a subset of Asian states, and et cetera, et cetera. So one set of rules, or multiple sets of rules, or the rule of the jungle. We don't know. And in this increasingly difficult world, one asks oneself, what will be the role of Europe? What will be the role of Europe in the world? You can put it into a simple question. Will Europe be a player, or will it be played with? And if one wants to be a player, we've got these small member states like Germany and France and so on, who realize that by themselves they are simply too small to be relevant on a global scale. And that is why one has to project oneself onto the global stage as a united Europe. But how can one do that? Because trying to be united, trying to be unified, trying to speak with one voice, increasingly is impacting on issues that are associated with sovereignty, with nationalism, populism, and to a certain extent, these questions about how does a united Europe, how does that work with continued sovereignty of nation states, those are relevant and important questions. But they have become a powerful driver of populist movements. And if one agrees that one has to project oneself onto the global scale, that one can only project oneself on a global scale in a fragmented, multipolar world, if one is united and speaks with one voice, then the question arises, how does one get there? Is the present model of European integration, is that actually suited and suitable for such a world, where the multilateral rules-based order is decried by many as being illegitimate or illegitimately reigning in national sovereignty, which is exactly what the European Union is about. That national sovereignty in doing things is reined in. And that's, I think, if you talk to people in Italy right now, if you talk to people in this country, which is still part of the European Union, this is exactly this constitutional dilemma is at the core of the problems. And so far, the European model of integration has rested on, for this discussion, two essential elements. The one is the indivisibility of the acquis communautaire, which means that the European rules, the regulations, the law are applicable to everybody. This is the principle. The practice is, of course, different, as especially one knows in the UK, which has an opt-out from such policies as the euro and Schengen and the like. So first principle, the indivisibility. The second one is the irreversibility, which we strongly believed in. You can't go back. Once you've agreed to something, you're in. As I said, we've nevertheless had significant exceptions. So not only the opt-outs of the UK, but others, right through things that people generally didn't know about, the European divorce settlements, patent law where the Spaniards are not participating, and flags and symbols. So the most arcane issues as well, where not all 28 are participating. But the principle as such was fixed. Now, why is this getting more and more difficult nowadays? In the old days, we were dealing with issues essentially of the, for the sake of argument, of the internal market on goods, internal market on services. We especially, thanks to the UK initiatives, moved increasingly towards qualified majority voting, and that made the European Union more efficient. It helped in integrating markets. And you could have argued, but that also takes away sovereignty, because if you're outvoted, quite obviously, that what your politicians wanted did not come about. What were people voting on in the 80s and the 90s? If one wants to be slightly facetious, we're voting on tractor seats and other issues concerned with free trade in goods. So if you're outvoted on tractor seats, what the heck? You go home and said, bad luck, the shape of the tractor seat is different, or I didn't manage to get what I wanted on capital requirements for banks. Does it matter? Probably not too much. Does it matter to the population at large? Possibly not at all. And now we're in a situation where the issue of integrating markets is, let's say, two-thirds done. There's still quite a lot outstanding on services. But we've increasingly moved into the more difficult areas. Difficult issues externally and internally, such as migration, security policy, foreign policy, euro area budgets, and the like. And these issues are much more central to the constitutional prerogatives of national parliaments. Think of budgetary issues. Think of migration. These are issues that are not only central to the constitutional prerogatives of parliaments, but they are of terrific national political importance. And then there are a couple of models of how you deal with coming to solutions on these issues. Solution number one, which is appears to be increasingly the case in the European Union on these very complex issues, you make no progress. The second issue, the second possibility of how you deal with these issues is you give people an opt-out. And that has happened repeatedly over the last 20 years. I've mentioned the euro, I've mentioned Schengen, and others. And the third possibility, which I've also mentioned, is majority voting. And as I said, majority voting was fine for the tractor seat. Majority voting was fine for capital requirements for banks and this, that, and the other. But is majority voting okay for things such as managing migration? Can you have majority voting on issues such as fiscal, where your national parliament, this is the core economic policy competence of your national parliament, can you be outvoted there? And we've seen a good example. There was a decision on managing migration, which was arrived at through majority vote, and it wasn't implemented. And it wasn't implemented because people then realized how central the issue is politically to member states. So we've reached a level of integration where we simply can't either have a complete standstill or have a constant patchwork of flexibility, opt-outs, and the other, and we can't just outvote the blighters if they don't feel like, if they say, can't go there. And additionally, of course, heterogeneity has gone up with past enlargements. Heterogeneity, probably the big jump was from 15 up to now 28. Nearly any parameter that you look at, per capita GDP, regional differences, attitudes, what have you not, on all of these counts, heterogeneity in Europe has gone up, and the consequence of a larger distribution around the mean of attitudes towards issues simply means that arriving at a consensual decision is that much more difficult. So we have reached the outer limits, in my view, of what we can do with the present model of integration. That's a view which is not shared by colleagues, by many colleagues in Brussels. They say, nope, we've got one model and one size fits all, and we've got the treaty, and if we decide to do something, we all do it jointly. And yes, we've had the exceptions on this, that, and the other, but the 28, or to be 27, should be joining in all policies. And my answer is, forget it. The result will simply be, we'll have no decision on anything, and you will have complete standstill. And so there are no easy choices available, because as I said, we're moving into areas which deal very centrally with national sovereignty. And this is, of course, a debate which is also important in the present circumstances for the UK. And you've got two ways of looking at sovereignty, national sovereignty, especially in a united or not quite united Europe. And the one way of looking at it is to say, what is important to me is constitutional sovereignty. Constitutional sovereignty means I have no legal constraint on acts that my parliament is supposed to pass. No legal constraints on passing legislation. That's the constitutional sovereignty. And this is an issue which is the prototype of such countries is Switzerland. They are very strong constitutionalists. UK increasingly as well. And so you've got the constitutionalists, and then you've got the economists, and they say, well, sovereignty means for me what are the practical constraints in the real world in a probably deeply linked global economy, and what are the constraints that are posed on my business, on my parliament, by international rules and the requirements of the market on domestic rules and regulations? If I'm a Norwegian producer of tractor seats, Am I any way limited in the way my tractor seats are fabricated because I want to export them? Of course they are. So there's a practical and a constitutional way of looking at sovereignty. And sovereignty has very much to do, of course, with autonomy. So if we look at it this way, there is one country which I regard as being truly sovereign and autonomous, and that's North Korea. They face very few constraints on their activity. To a certain degree, probably the US and China are also fairly autonomous, also thanks to their military capabilities. But the smaller the countries get, right down to these small countries like Germany and France, even without the European Union, we are deeply constrained by international rules and the de facto constraints on our autonomy by international trade and international competition. And being these smaller countries like Germany and France, how do you regain the sovereignty which you de facto lose because of the requirements of globalized economy? You start pooling economy, pooling sovereignty. And that's what, let's say, the federalists in Europe dream about or think about. They say, if we completely pool our sovereignty, then we will be able to speak with one voice, we will have one foreign policy, we will have one migration policy, and so on and so forth. But that is something which, I think, step back, which conflicts, of course, if you pool sovereignty completely, this conflicts, of course, with your constitutional requirements. Can one pool sovereignty and ignore the constitutional requirements? No, I think not, because we need to respect these differences. We need to respect the different requirements of different constitutions, and so we need a certain new model to overcome this the problem by this diversity and the constraints that are placed on our policies. So this, of course, is not a new question. Europe has always been very diverse. There have also always been these different, difficult requirements of European integration. And Jacques Delors in the 80s already was developing models of how to deal with the fact that there was this core of existing member states, 12 at the time. How do you move forward with the 12 if you've got small, very small neutral states wanting to join? There was the model of, how does one translate, plusieurs vitesse?
Multi-speed.
Multi-speed. Multi-speed Europe. You had concentric circles, you had all different models, but they essentially, they had the big center of the 12, which would move together jointly, steadily, and an outer circle of countries that would have a lower degree of integration within the 12 than you could possibly have different speeds. So, this is one way of how we have been thinking about this. Do we want to move to a world of concentric circles? It has its advantages. And it's a bit, concentric circles is a bit like a restaurant with a very limited menu. You open the menu and you see there are three different choices, and you get the soup and the main course and the pudding and the drink. You can choose between three different sets, and those are the concentric circles. So there is not a lot of variety in there. You don't get much choice. It is institutionally simple because there is then one commission, one council at the center, and the outer circles simply do not participate in all of these policies. However, because at the maximum you could have 3 or 4 circles, you probably would be forced to be participating in policies that you don't want. In one circle you'd have Euro and Schengen and migration and this, that, and the other. The others would be participating in none of them. So the variety of the menu is too small. So we said, there must be something different, not only 3 circles and you get in your menu, you get to choose something which you have to choose, which you don't really want. So let's think about a Europe of clubs. You'd have a club, sort of a main club internal market. You'd have a club Euro, you'd have a club Schengen, you'd have a club common security and foreign policy, etc., etc. And all of these would be regulated by stable and self-contained, coherent agreements. The problem there is, with all of these clubs, there is no center which holds it together. You've got a huge variety. Think of this as the restaurant menu, and you pick this, that, and the other. But you'd probably have a huge patchwork of nearly uncorrelated policies. You would have the issue of cherry-picking, inconsistencies, and the like. So after lengthy discussions, we moved to a synthetic model, saying this is what we present to Commission and others in Brussels as something that can solve the impasse which we are suffering from. And it rests on something which we call the bare-bone Europe, which is essentially the internal market. It is narrower than the present European Union. So you'd have membership of the bare-bone European Union would be probably have less requirements than the present EU. It would encompass customs union, something which people in the UK know more about than they used to about a year ago or 2 years ago. Internal.
But still not very much.
I remember a discussion on rules of origin with Ollie Robbins 2 years back. Where was I? Internal market, customs union. Yes, free movement, because that is a sine qua non. If you are participating in the internal market, it's one of the essential four freedoms. It would not encompass the Euro or Schengen or common security and foreign policy, etc. But that is something, if you are part of the European Union, that is something you have to participate in. And on top of this bare bones center, we arrived at 4 clubs. Euro club, Schengen, and migration. Just as an example of what these things need to encompass. If you are participating in Schengen, common rules on migration, this goes as far, obviously, as having joint requirements on visa, citizenship, etc. Euro, Schengen, common security and foreign policy, and then a 4th bucket which encompasses all other issues that are not in this bare bones European Union. Is there a huge difference compared to where we are today? Well, you'd have coherent clubs, as it were. They would have a set of joint institutions. They would have clear rules, clear decision making. You would have admittedly varying degrees of intergovernmentalism, which is something we have used widely over the past 10 years in the Euro area in setting up the institutions we created over the last 10 years. And you would probably have to, we're sure that you would have to allow for a significant extension of majority voting within those clubs.
which means that you probably have to have deep discussion domestically, probably referenda, if you want to move towards and into these clubs, because that is what it ultimately could be about, that by joining not only the bare bones European Union, but also that part that deals with Schengen, migration, visa, etc., 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 you accept, you admit that you would accept majority voting on these areas. But that would have to be done not by the back door as we are trying to do it nowadays, but this would have to be done by a constitutionally clean and decent treaty that regulates these things in conformity with constitutional and parliamentary requirements of the individual member states. But not everybody would have to participate, and not everybody would want to participate. So this is how we believe that we could overcome the present impasse of European integration. But Europe, of course, is not only the EU 28 or 27. We have not very orderly, rather messy relationships with the European countries outside the European Union, and soon to be more outside the European Union than they are at present. And I got a very strong conviction that the way in which these relationships are handled nowadays need also to be put onto different footing. At present, they follow very, very many different models. We've got the European Economic Area, in which Norway and Iceland and Liechtenstein are participating. We've got the messy relationship with Switzerland, where we've got 110 different agreements with Switzerland at present, troubled manner. We've got the accession process, the stalled accession process of the Western Balkans. We've got the catastrophe in and with the Ukraine. And we've got to think about the future relationship with the United Kingdom. And so I think what we need is to put these arrangements onto a more participatory footing. Up to now, these have been handled nearly exclusively in a bilateral manner between the Commission and the countries concerned, which has prevented any political buy-in by the member states of the European Union. The diversity of these relationships has also acted as a significant break of trade and integration between those countries that are outside the European Union. And therefore, you need a different institutional setup, and you need a different political setup, which cannot be one joint exercise, but it should be more homogeneous than we have at present. So I think I've more or less run out of time. To sum up, we live in a messy world, multipolar, many different competing sets of rules ahead of us. Europe needs to figure out how it can be a player on this global stage, or otherwise people will simply play with Europe. Present model of integration has come to the end of its usefulness. We need to set up something new. It needs to respect the constitutional concerns of member states. You cannot force everybody to be in one big, jointly united European Union. Possibility is either you just stop dead in your tracks, or you outvote everybody, or you have a different model. The bare bones European Union with different sets of very limited set of different clubs would seem to me and my co-authors to fulfill these requirements. It's not going to happen over the next 1 or 2 years, but we have generated a very heated and sometimes unpleasant debate with very principled friends in Brussels and other countries. So I look forward to a heated, but I hope friendly debate on these issues.
Thank you, Thomas.
As you can hear, there is plenty of potential provocation in what Thomas says. If you'll allow me, I'll put one question to him and then invite the audience to think of their questions, which we'll take maybe in groups of three. My question to you, Thomas, is an obvious devil's advocate one. I'm going to pretend I'm Jean-Claude Juncker. I'm not going to kiss you on the head the way he's normally inclined to do, but he would say, this is all very well, Thomas, but we cannot have a Europe of first-class and second-class countries. Otherwise, it isn't going to function. How would you answer this charge?
Is this the first of three questions which we're generating now, or should we give the people more time to...
There's one for me, and then you answer, and then we'll generate three.
Right. More time to reflect. Well,
if you have a certain set of clubs for the euro, for migration, etc., etc. Firstly, it's a conscious choice of member states that they want to participate, and they have to actively do so in order to get into that club. Whereas nowadays, they try to sneak out by the back door. So it's more orderly. Today, we have an nearly unspecifiable, messy map of Europe with exceptions here, opt-outs there, and the whole geometry of first and second class will change enormously once the UK leaves the European Union. I think for now you've had a fairly balanced representation with 19 member states participating in the euro, 9 not. And the size of the 9 was, thanks to the UK, fairly large. And it was vocal and their policies were well articulated. But once the UK leaves, the relationship between the 19 and the 8 will change completely. And what is today a fairly balanced balance will all of a sudden tilt. And that is when, indeed, I think there is a danger of moving towards first class, second class. Because then there is also a danger that countries will not be perceived as not wanting to join the euro, but not being allowed to join the euro. Coupled with joining the euro today is joining banking union. And already at present, we have a country or two who would love to join the euro, but it's not working out. People are not listening to them. They're not allowed to somehow, they're not managing to join the exchange rate mechanism.
This is Bulgaria you're talking about.
Possibly. They are not capable of joining banking union, etc., etc., etc. So I think for now there is a slight perception possibly between first class and second class, but as soon as the UK leaves, then it would really become first and second class citizens. And that is something the people in the UK don't realize, people in Germany and France don't realize, but the people in Sweden and in Hungary and in Poland, they're vividly aware of it. And that is also a driver, was a driver for us to look at alternative models of integration, which would simply make it more
let's say, transparent in what you are participating because you can participate, not because you're kept out.
Will you allow me to put it slightly more pointedly? Germany and France are going to be in all four clubs. Probably the Netherlands, Austria, and one or two other countries will be in all four clubs. So they're then both their geographical core and the club core. Everyone else who participates only in one, two, three, or even the fourth club will be seen as being in a different category from those core members. Is that not a potential problem?
I don't think so. I think countries that don't want to or cannot participate in common security and foreign policy, they genuinely don't want to, and therefore they don't feel ostracized by not doing so. Countries that do not want to join, that do not want to have a common migration policy, they enjoy not participating in a joint migration policy. But there is, of course, the question, does this differentiated model, would that apply to all present 27/28 member states? Could you sort of move backward? Or is it something that you would start applying only to new members once Western Balkans start moving closer towards membership? I would say, well, yes, if Hungary does not want to participate in a common migration policy, then it will not be able to participate in Schengen. But that's something you can't say in Brussels because you can't take away integration achievements from individual member states. And you could not do that against their own will. So the big question also is, how do you bunch together the different policy areas, such as Schengen migration visa? You can't have one but not the others. Yeah. But I don't right. think, yeah. It's a good question.
Let's open it today. Francisco, you caught my eye. Please be as brief as possible and try to make it a question rather than a political statement and say who you are. There's a microphone coming, I think, over here. Any other takers at this point? Oh, many, right. One here and next.
Thank you very much. I would ask you if...
Just say who you are, Francisco. Yes. Just tell us
who are you?
Francisco Torres from the European Institute. Thank you. I would like to ask you if whether we should not talk about variable geometry Europe instead of variable geometry EU. And the reason is that it's not as simple as you would like to stay in the internal market as a core together with the customs union, and then if you wanted you would join EMU and other things, because of the need of a common destiny and solidarity and accountability in some the construction of Europe. You saw already the problems of perceiving the internal market as such and not as a support for monetary union. That leads a bit to conflict. That was the position of the UK before. It wanted to be recognized as countries non-participating in EMU with the sole right of developing their strategy, developing the internal market as such and not as a way to foster monetary union. So how you see this incompatibility?
Okay, thank you. If you pass the micro to your left, that's the right. And over, you'll come next, but there's a question over here first.
Okay. I take a bit issue with the whole formulation of the title and then also your solution. I mean, first of all, the whole club solution sees heterogeneity, or as you also called it, diversity as a problem. Why is it? Diversity and diverse interests in an integration project has always driven European integration. If it were just for the Netherlands and Germany, that the euro would never have come about. It was France or Italy that wanted it, and then Germany for its own reasons why they wanted to have it. And it also makes good economic sense. Diversity allows us to pool risks and to diversify them away, while if we're all alike, then we always are subject to the same shocks. And also then the does one size fit all, as if we had now one size fit all, but we don't. The EU has highly differentiated integration and often meta rules, for example, for social policy or portability, migration, under which a lot of different institutional settings in member states can flourish. And I think that is what we need to think much harder about. How much diversity can we allow for and actually actively encourage without the negative externalities? That is clear. That has to be reined in. But this idea is one that I'm afraid is the same mindset that creates the mess today. The Trumps of this world want only some like us and not all these great unwashed Mexicans. And Europe shouldn't be like that, because we are diverse, and that's a source of richness and not a source of concern.
Third question behind you here.
My name is Richard Cunningham. A simple question. I'm not sure if the answer is simple. How flexible would you envisage membership of these clubs to be? So, for example, Poland might want to not join 1 year. They have an election. The next government might choose to join it, and the next one might choose to leave it. Could you renew membership every 5 years or whenever you liked? What would your view be on things like that? Because electorates do change their mind and their attitudes to all sorts of things. Some want to join NATO, some might want to leave NATO, that sort of thing.
Musical chairs, are we going to allow it? Okay, but maybe try to bring together your answers for these three questions.
I'm not quite sure if I got completely right the drift of your question, but I'll think about it while answering the others. I think starting from the end, yes. Once you enter a club, you need to make the entry hurdles clear and the exit hurdles high. And if you indeed have voting rules that go beyond simple requirements of unanimity, you'd probably have to clear quite a number of constitutional hurdles domestically. So the incentive of staying in is a very strong one. Our experience to date, barring the UK referendum, has been you don't go back. I had these discussions with Varoufakis et alii. But in the end, so far, I think we've had hardly any experience of a country agreeing to a step of integration and then saying, oops, I've changed my mind. But you can't exclude it. And so probably you would have agreements which say you can't go back, or you have huge hurdles in wanting to leave. But in reality, if you want to leave, you want to leave. That's why we have Article 50 in the treaty. And not having had Article 50 would not have precluded these unhappy procedures. It simply made them orderly.
You call it orderly?
Compared to what would have been the case without Article 50. The issue of diversity, I think that's... Of course, Europe is diverse. And nobody is talking of producing a Trumpian potpourri made up of totally homogenized elderly white male voters.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, you know, every time we look in the mirror. Europe is, one says, united in diversity. So the way you were putting it, was as if we want to get rid of European diversity. Every Catalonian has to become like a citizen of Wuppertal, and every Hungarian has to become like a citizen of Wuppertal. But as we know, that's not the case. Diversity will exist, and I come from a very small European country where people in the east of the country hardly understand the dialect of those from the west of the country. Now everybody's watching German TV, so these differences are disappearing. But so diversity has existed for hundreds of years and will continue to. But has this diversity made it more difficult over time to grapple with the challenges that we are facing? Grapple with the challenges that we are facing as Europe. One, because of the sheer existence of 28 member states instead of 12 or 15, it has become more difficult to find an overlap of interests than it was when the fairly homogeneous set of 15 member states tried to take decisions. And you have interests that are here and here and here and here. And back in the 80s and the 90s, it was already difficult enough to agree between the Germans and the French, or the Dutch and the British, and the da-da-da-da-da. But one managed. With 28 member states, purely logically, the area of overlap of interest shrinks dramatically. So one can say, what the heck? It has shrunk dramatically. So we just take decisions on those issues where there's an overlap of interest. That would be fine for the world up until 89. We had the huge certainties of East and West. We had a nice iron curtain. You had the security dichotomy between the Americans and the Russians that kept the Europeans on their toes, etc., etc. We know all these stories. So, but things have changed. There is no longer this East-West frozen conflict or antagonistic interest. It has multipolarized itself. And Europe can no longer rest under the umbrella of the North Atlanticist rules-based system of the WTO and rely on the IMF to the extent that it could and all other rule-setting institutions. So we need to become more proactive and take more decisions and not less decisions than up until into the 90s. And the third issue is we're done more or less with the easy things. We've taken decisions on tractor seats and capital requirements and this, that, and the other, notwithstanding services still not being as liberalized as they could be. But the decisions that we're taking, that we need to take in this world of mass movement of people, where you can't have national rules on migration, where you have even global public goods like environmental concerns, should we rely on voting in the council on all of these issues by unanimity? Then we will never have any position at all. We're up the creek without a paddle. So I don't think that by having different sets of integration, you decrease diversity. What you could have is that if there is a club for, let's say, security and foreign policy in which only 6 or 7 member states participate, that the voice of that club on the global scale would probably not be heard. So there's probably a certain hurdle which you've got to clear in terms of participation and membership. Say it again, short version.
Right, I'll paraphrase maybe. Is it a question of clubs within the EU or within Europe? That was the beginning of the question.
But I've been trying to...
In other words, could we be thinking of Ukraine, Turkey?
Yeah. Either you're in the European Union and then you've got the bare bones European Union. And that is, for sure, every way you look at it, and this is not, this is logically impossible to change. You've got to have the internal market, you've got to have customs union, you've got to have the four freedoms. You don't need the euro, you don't need Schengen, you don't need a couple of others. But I don't see Turkey or others participating. No, we haven't.
Very quickly, please.
The core is the internal market. You're saying that the core would be the internal market and you would join other clubs. Can you have a core without EMU?
Without EMU?
EMU, Economic and Monetary Union. It's not the core of Europe. Because if you want to develop
I know all the arguments. That's why we had EMU, because we said you can't have a true internal market if you have these currency fluctuations within da-da-da-da-da-da. I think the answer is you can, despite the strong intellectual arguments which said that if you have an internal market, currency fluctuations mess it up. Again, we still haven't got it. We still haven't got it.
Okay.
The UK with its exchange rate flexibility against first the Deutschmark and then against the euro showed that you can participate in a well-functioning internal market even though you don't have a joint currency.
All right, we must move on, Francisco, because others are waiting to ask questions. Did you want one, Perishka?
Yeah, I want, but my question has been
on. Okay, Mario?
Yes, two short questions. The first is, what about the opposite? You could envisage in the future countries that would like to join the euro, but not the European Union as a whole. And the second is, on this increasing strength of populism and nationalism and strong governments, do you think that, how this interacts with integration in the long term?
So Corrado Macchiarelli, European Institute. So the way I understand the argument is that you're saying, well, essentially we cannot allow everyone to progress at the same pace. I mean, we're talking about the EU, if I understand correctly, so assuming that the euro area is the sort of hardcore of this process. But to me, the question, and that I'm going to turn it to a question to you, is are we right in still thinking in sort of 1990s or terms, in the sense that if we look at the process of integration, more generally, we're still relying on parameters that maybe are no longer valid today. And we've been living in like 10-year recession or stagnation, and certainly there is a huge structural break in economic terms, and maybe we should rethink about what convergence means rather than say, well, let's slow down and create sort of tier one and tier two clubs. It's more of a fundamental and, if you like, constitutional issue about Europe. And so what do you think about it?
There's a third question this round here, please.
Hi, how would you...
Could you tell us who you are again?
Oh, Agnès Belaïch from the LSE, Institute of Global Affairs. How would your proposal would resolve the issues within the Eurozone? since the reforms are relatively stuck there? And are you reopening the Euro Club as well? Thanks.
Thank you. Several more provocations for you there, Thomas.
Well, the Euro started out, and for the first year, 10 years of its existence, was something that relied more or less on, let's say, the received voting modalities and decision-making modalities of the treaty. And then things started to happen in 2009, 2010, and we had to set up a variety of different institutions, which were of an intergovernmental nature, essentially because they were creating liabilities or contingent liabilities which national parliaments had to agree to. And these unanimity requirements made life excessively difficult for many of us. So what you could possibly have in such a Euro Club is that if you have a constitutional treaty that goes significantly beyond the Maastricht Treaty, is that you increasingly move towards a kind of majority voting on those issues which today are constrained by the requirement of unanimity voting. So it would change the intergovernmental nature of much of what we are doing to a treaty-based nature, i.e., change the nature of the euro, and you shift the some of the constitutional requirements to the European level. Your issue on I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Are you saying let's not deal with decision making and how complex Europe has become? Let's deal with inequality and regional differences within Europe. Well, as a side note, I was quite some years ago, I was at a meeting at the European University Institute in Florence, and by some fluke of seating, was a long row, big table, a long row of economists from south of the Alps sitting on the one side of the table, and a long row of economists coming from the north side of the Alps sitting on the other side of the table. And there was total uniformity of view on the one side of the table and the completely opposite, the total uniformity of views on the other side of the table. So, funnily enough, where you come from totally determines your economics, and that, I thought, was a precise science. There was only Beatrice Veda Di Mauro and myself who were not true to form.
And that's because you're in the Alps.
Yeah, we can never make up our mind. Wherever you turn, there's mountains. So the one does not exclude the other, to put it more neutrally. Does the fact that real convergence has not worked as people were hoping, does that imply that you should not make the European Union more efficient? No. You can have a whole semester-long seminar on inequality in Europe and what are the contributions of Europe, to what extent does Europe contribute to these inequalities and to what positively and negatively. I am increasingly certain that there is a certain centripetal growth effect of the internal market. What I'm asking myself is there, in addition to the centripetal effect of the internal market, is there one of the euro because of increased exchange rate, because of the large exchange rate stability that you have, does this increase these forces, and is there therefore a greater danger of depopulation, impoverishment, loss of production in the periphery or not. Nevertheless, decisions need to be made. So it's an issue I think a lot about, but I don't think that it's directly related. It's indirectly related to the issue at hand. And on Mario's question, you're looking, putting yourself outside the European Union, if I understood correctly, and say, can you sort of pick pieces and bits out of the building? And I don't know. It depends on the complementarities that are set up within these clubs. Are they self-containable or not? Is this an esoteric question? No. Why? If you have this club on common security and foreign policy, what will be the future relationship of the United Kingdom with that? You want to have some kind of participation, association, membership? I don't know. So it depends. I don't think you would want to not participate in the internal market, customs union, and including free movement of labor, but pick out Schengen and migration. You wouldn't want to do it. You have a country which is part of the euro because of Deutschmarkization, Montenegro, which through the back door, because they had the Deutschmark, now they've got the euro. But are they part of the euro club with everything that it entails? Obviously not. They're not part of, they're a monetary policy taker. They don't participate in banking union and the fiscal rules, etc., etc., etc. So just having the currency in itself doesn't make it a member of the club. And we're going to have to deal one day with the headache of a country having the euro but joining the European Union when it shouldn't have the euro.
But to extend Mario's question, is it a sine qua non of being in the euro club that you should be in the core first? Could Argentina join the euro?
You could join the euro, but you couldn't be in the euro club. Or you could introduce the euro, but you could not join the euro. That's something different. It's dollarization is always possible, but you don't succumb directly to the monetary policy of the Fed. So unilateral euroization is a possibility, but that's not joining the euro. So I think that's probably how I'd answer it. Yeah.
Okay, let's take another quick couple. You were first, and then second, third, okay? This will be the last round.
Hi, my name is Angelos Angelou. I'm a PhD student in the European Institute. And I work a lot on debt management, especially when you were chair of your working group. So I wanted to tap on what you said before about the heterogeneity of preferences between the member states and the national leaders. And I'm wondering if you can draw any lessons from your experience in Brussels on how heterogeneity of preference was managed in the Council during the crisis, when I assume there was some heterogeneity, but we still had to actually find some common ground.
Mm-hmm. And then lady over here.
Hello, thank you very much for coming. My question might be a bit surprising, but came to mind and I had to ask. Was talking about managing heterogeneity, you talked about alternative model of integration, and with narratives of political integration emerging in debate, I was wondering, do you think the EU can survive without a mass identity?
Without
a mass identity, like a mass European identity.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then mm-hmm. Last question over here.
Hello, my name is Till Plown. I'm a student here at the European Institute. My question relates more like to the people in a way, because you coined sovereignty, but you never talk about the people. And I think in a democratic system, the sovereign are the people. And I feel that in the European Union at the moment, the people don't feel integrated, and they don't feel that EU integration is responsive to their interests. So when you talk about a euro of bare bone and collapse, I see it as an intergovernmental EU of disintegration and status quo, but I don't see it as a model for integration. So my question would be, based on your proposal, where is the integration based on a European debate on integration, where the people, for example, in the European Parliament could decide for more integration? Because as I see it, your barebone, where this central institution would just be an economic barebone, where you can't go for integration beyond economic integration. So where is further political integration if the people of Europe would wanted this?
Good questions. Are we moving on to citizens now?
Right. I think the two of your questions are quite related, so I'll start off with them, heterogeneity. Which crisis? We had so many. We had the great financial crisis, we had the banking crisis, we had the sovereign debt crisis, we had the euro crisis, and the migration crisis, to name but a few. And as they say, the fear of hanging focuses man's mind. So during the euro crisis, people were quite aware of what had to be done. There was a strong heterogeneity, nevertheless, of policy preferences. Again, south of the Alps and north of the Alps. Ultimately, I'd say to the disgust of those from south of the Alps, those from the north waited much too long. And to the disgust of some north of the Alps, they went considerably further in mutualizing risk, as they would call it, than they would have preferred to do. So, there are many people who say that the crisis was so deep because it was not that the wrong decisions were taken, but that the right decisions were taken much too late. And this feeling of procrastination is something that I will remember for a long, long time. And that was, of course, frustrating. It spooked markets and led to, I would say, probably loss of GDP and loss of employment being higher than it otherwise would need to have been. So, expressed differently, despite all of this heterogeneity of preferences, the decisions were taken, but they were taken too late. Would there have been a preference for going even further? Yes. So there was a certain middle ground, which was where the decisions landed. Of course, there were many people who would have preferred to completely mutualize risk from the outset, and there were others, some people resigning as Bundesbank presidents, who said that even the small steps that were taken already had gone too far. On mass identity. I'll start the answer by
referring to monetary unions, is there by and large agreement that there needs to be a further deepening of economic and monetary union for it to become more stable, da 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 da, and most people would agree that yes. And then they look at federal states like the United States or Switzerland and say, as long as economic and monetary union does not have the institutions that the Americans have, that the Swiss have, things won't function. And that is a view which I challenge, because the euro is a monetary union which can be different from existing federal models, which doesn't mean that not additional things need to be done. So can the European Union survive? Can it thrive? Can it survive well without people having only a European identity? If you ask my son, he grew up in a fairly international household, international school in Vienna at present. He's at a technical university in Germany. What his identity is, he will look at you and say, European? And if you were to ask him, are you a good Austrian, he would snigger and say, good? Let's go and have a beer.
Proving he's a good Austrian.
Yeah, too many, yeah. So, yes, there is a generation which sees themselves as Europeans and Austrians, but is he a patriotic Austrian, my son? Definitely not. Does he feel attached to the town in which he grew up? Definitely yes. So I think it's more, if you talk to Americans, they say, where are you from? They will probably say California. They will possibly not admit to Oklahoma, but they will say California. And everybody knows that's part of the United States. Or New York, or Vermont, or despite being good Americans, but they will first and foremost identify themselves as coming from a certain part, and that is, I think, how we live in Europe nowadays, that we have a strong identity, that being European means that you're different from non-Europeans to a certain extent, but being a European doesn't exclude being also a good Italian, German, Luxembourgeois, etc., etc. So will there ever be a mass identity that you only identify as a European? Never, ever. Never, ever. But that, I think, doesn't have any effect on the thriving of the European Union. And the people. The people. Maybe I'm not a very good person to ask that. Martin Schulz once called me the greatest enemy of European democracy because I said that the present decision-making powers of the European Parliament, that the pretense of decision-making powers of the European Parliament are greater than the reality. And I would put it differently. Does the German government, the French government, the Italian government, the Austrian government, are they perceived by a large part of their populations as being responsive to what the populations want? No. I think we agree on that. If you look at Eurobarometer surveys, there is a very, very peculiar thing if you look closely. And the peculiar thing is that there is
with two or three exceptions, people, oh, let's start the sentence again. Do the people in Germany, France, Austria, etc., do they agree, whatever that means, with the European Union? And you get percentages like 63%, 70%, 54%. And that gives rise to comments as agreement with the European Union, 2 percentage points up or 4 percentage points down, and people obsess about that. Turn the page and look at the same respondents answering the question, are you in agreement with your government? And with two or three exceptions, the people are more in agreement with Europe than with their own government.
But is Europe obsessed too much about economics, not enough about
citizens? I was getting there. Now, the present setup of the European Union is one of member states where you have to work, for better or for worse, under the realistic assumption that what the representatives of the member states are saying and putting before you is the expression of the will of their people, which in some of our countries is more difficult to believe than in others, but voila. What is the response of true believers in European federalism? Let's have genuine European elections. Let's have a European government. That's fine on paper or as a very long-term vision. There was the attempt with the Maastricht Treaty version 1 to go in that direction by having a European constitution. As if and when you have a European constitution that is above the constitutions of all constitutions of member states, bingo. That's when you're there, but not before. Because if you have collective European elections that produce a European government, which is the sovereign, which is the expression of the European sovereign, and which therefore is constitutionally above national governments and above the national constitutions, then you can talk about the expression of the interests of the people that are not channeled and organized through national elections and whatever their bloody representatives then in the Council or the European Parliament say. So, maybe yes, that Europe is too much about economics, but maybe yes, also Germany is too much about some questions, and France too much about other questions. Do we individually have the feeling that we are represented by our own governments, and we all come from many different countries, I guess. Does anybody have the strong feeling that their government is truly representing what you and your friends and your family want and are thinking? Don't ask me what I think about the present Austrian government. Or you can. So, I don't have a good answer for you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Let me conclude with asking you in about one sentence to give an answer to this very straightforward question. If Europe does not follow your recommendation of going in the direction of clubs, does Europe or the European Union risk unraveling?
It doesn't have to follow my ideas, but it has to become more efficient. If it doesn't become more efficient and reaches decisions on the big and important questions of our globe, then we will simply stand still. And if we stand still and everybody else is moving and progressing, then in relative terms we will fall back. So in the medium term, we will just stay where we are. But if you stay for too long where you are,
stasis.
Yes, at least, at best.
Okay, well, we've exceeded our time. So will you join me in thanking Thomas Wieser for a very insightful talk?